Tonight I'd like to go back and excuse me, explore some of the challenges and some of the struggles that our leadership faces. And I thank you this morning for those of you who were able to participate in that prayer that we had for our leaders here in our country, knowing that we don't pray just for our president, but for our vice president, for our Congress, for all of our leaders. There is a lot that goes on every day in all parts of the world that we don't even know about. And sometimes we just get so busy in our own little rut that we forget to take time to do what's important. So I'm encouraging you to join us together in that prayer. Now more than ever, I think it's really important. But tonight I'd like us to look at going back and looking at the weight on a king. And I'd like tonight to do some, close our service with some examples from Israel's first kings and to see what lessons that there are there. But tonight as we begin, our first point is that with great power comes great responsibility. Of course, in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 4, we found this. Where there is a word of a king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? Understanding our priority and how it is that we address our kings and our leaders. And sometimes, you know, we think about the powers that be and the people in charge, and sometimes we just don't give authority the proper respect that it requires or that accompanies the job. And when you certainly don't respect the leader, we need to respect the office. I think that's the principle there. And again, I'm not talking, this isn't a message stated in time for specifically a person or instance I'm thinking about. This is just a good lifelong principle that we have when we come to view our leaders and the authority that God has placed over us. Because we recognize where that source of power comes from. And oftentimes for us, it's really easy for us to be critical of our leadership, because they are the ones, rightfully so, the buck does stop at the top. And rightfully so, as John Maxwell said, everything rises and falls on leadership. Leadership does carry an incredible burden. And so when we're in the middle of an election cycle, we just had these primaries competitions just coming back out, as I thought about the candidates who are running for office, as I wondered how many of them have really weighed the true cost of serving the public. Oftentimes it's a thankless job, and oftentimes there's a whole lot of grief that comes along with it, because there's a whole lot that they could get wrong. And I am grateful for the fact that you and I, in the Holy Scriptures, but we understand that we're sometimes governed by individuals that don't follow our same values. And how and what is our response to those leaders? After all, who wouldn't want the comforts of great power and great wealth that comes along with being in charge? I think a lot of times people think that what comes along with being on top, and I have even thought about it in these terms as well, that the person in top, the person who makes those difficult decisions, it seems from the outside, because we use optics as our judging criteria. You know, the president of a corporation, Brother Clifton, what their life must be. They can just up and move their headquarters down to wherever it's convenient for them to move it to, because that's what his prerogative is. And we often think about how little visible the people at the top actually do as far as producing the work. And inherent with the job and inherent with that title, it seems to be that the leadership spends all of their time playing golf or just enjoying a comfortable lifestyle, jet-setting across the country or having power meetings or sitting back in an executive chair with their arms folded, never doing any work or sitting in that smaller lower chair that's designed for getting work done. It seems to be that the best job to have in any company would be to be the boss. Am I off on that observation? Most of us think we could do a pretty good job running whatever job we're doing. Now, Miss Debbie, running the locksmith, you're at the top. So this discounts you. And Brother Wayne, the watchworks, you run that watchworks, right? Or does it run you? It runs you. Okay. So we'll cut you some slack there. But I think you know where we're going with this. It seems to be that you'll hear a whole lot of criticism from a whole lot of people about the job performance, about the person at the top. And that's fair game, I suppose, that comes along with it, because who in the world wouldn't want those comforts that comes with great power and great wealth? But what we don't see is all the pressure and all the turmoil that comes along with it. We're not talking about powerful CEOs here. We're not talking about hedge fund managers. We're talking about kings. And there is a completely different class of leadership when you're dealing with kings, because they are not necessarily responsible for one particular company, but they are for overseeing the affairs of the kingdom. This morning, as we described, you know, what we use to identify how well a king's doing by the economy, or how much wealth is there in the kingdom, or how big, how many people there are in the kingdom, or even how healthy the kingdom is. But who in the world wouldn't want the comforts of great wealth and great power? And I'd like to introduce you tonight to a character from Greek literature. It's the story of the sword of Damocles. In this 4th century story in Sicily, there was a king, Dionysus, who sat and ruled and reigned over the kingdom. And one of his servants, Damocles, thought that he could do a pretty good job of running the kingdom. And so from some scenario, the king and Damocles, Dionysus and Damocles, decide to switch positions for the day. And King Dionysus, in his wisdom, understands that there is a tremendous amount of responsibility that comes with ruling and reigning the kingdom. The king who sits on the throne, of course, he has all of these people who sit at his feet, and they do that thing with the fan. You know, husbands, you know what I'm talking about, when you come home and your wife does that thing with that big feather fan to fan you off, or brings you the fruit bowl and feeds you the grapes. You know, that's the life of a king. That's not the way life is in your kingdom. That's the way it is in my kingdom. There above the throne, King Dionysus has installed a sword. And at the hilt, at the very top of the sword, it is suspended from the ceiling by a single strand of horsehair that dangles right above the throne as an ever-present reminder of the weight and the dangers and the harms that a king faces. Now, as Damocles comes and sits on the throne, as he looks around at all of the great power and the opportunity he has to rule, that dangling sword just a few inches above his head is an ever-present reminder of the danger and the gravity of the situation that comes in ruling the kingdom. And having sat upon that throne for just a short time, Damocles begged to be able to get off that throne, because he did not like what came with that throne. Who wouldn't want great power and great wealth? There's a whole lot more baggage that we often discount. There's a whole lot more difficulty and hardship that we do not often consider when we think about what it's like at the top. This morning we said that the success of a king is measured in terms of how many loyal subjects serve him. That's actually the true measure of how effective a king is. I said this morning the word fidelity, that means loyalty. Sure, a king can have a whole lot of money, and he can get a whole lot of money and through corruption. We see that running rampant in the world today. But the amount of money in a coffer is not an indicator of how successful a kingdom is. The measure of a king is that loyalty of his subjects. Because the king himself is not someone who can go out and administrate the day-to-day affairs of the kingdom. He's got an important job sitting on a throne. It's the subjects that go out day by day by day. I think about in our country, the heroes who guard our borders, the heroes who set out in military bases around the world fighting to protect us, about the heroes that are stationed off our shores, about the men and women that walk our streets, helping police us, the firefighters who lay down their life. Just on Friday, there was a fire not too far from here. As I pulled into the church property Friday morning, there was the smoke that reminded me of the way it looked when that church van caught on fire. And I thought, oh, Lord, they got another one. But it wasn't one of our vehicles. It was a house not too far from here. And I'm grateful for the people who fight to protect us, the small foot soldiers. It's all part of the administration, all part of administering a kingdom, and it takes the loyalty of subjects in order to accomplish that. Think about the power of a king's word. After all, that's what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 4, where the word is, there is great power. A king speaks, and his subjects respond. In the life of David, remember that time when David was thirsty, and he mentions it to his mighty men, and they fight tooth and nail just to go fetch the king a cup of water. There's a lot of power in the king's words, but only so much as the loyalty of his subjects backs that word. The truth about loyalty is that it can be manufactured from a king to a subject. Kings can take shortcuts in demanding the loyalty from their subjects. And we see this throughout history through cruel kings who rule by fear. And at the end of the day, a kingdom that's ruled and reigned by fear, those kings often crumble. And their kingdoms crumble when the people say, enough. A king may manufacture loyalty or buy manufactured loyalty by offering promise of land or money. We see that here in our nation's history, how that the settlers came in and how there were tracts of land that were given by the King of England to his loyal subjects, who would later go on to be our forefathers in the battle for independence and freedom. And the promise of money, that's mercenaries. That's people who follow whoever has the right amount of money. And when your loyalties are connected to money, well, there's always someone who has a little bit more to offer you, a little bit more, and your loyalty can swing. Because money is the currency that you're using to judge the success of the kingdom. Or maybe it's promised position inside a kingdom. There is the promise of giving someone a prominent position. If you will serve me, I'll make you lord over this area. The problem with lordship, you know, I'm glad that in a sense that we don't live in the days of kings, having a property owner or a lord. I think today we might call them landlords, the people who have to manage the properties. But if you know a landlord, they are land overloaded. Landlords, it seemed to be, are always having to manage and having to take care of problems on the property. And it's not just sitting back and having your bank account get enriched by all the money that comes in. It takes a whole lot of work and a whole lot of resources in order to keep your houses and your tenants up. And to be a lord certainly sounds good on paper, but it is an awful lot of work and an awful lot of responsibility if you're going to do it right. So there are ways that a king can get his loyalty through fear, through endowment, through promised position. But the quality of this loyalty really hinges on how much I value what the king offers me. Think about it. The quality of our loyalty hinges upon how much I value what the king offers me. And I look right now the way our country works. If you listen to our politicians, there's a whole lot of fear-mongering. Well, they're going to take away your Social Security. And what is Social Security? But it's that retirement investment that that you have been working towards, that you have been given towards over the course of your career. Now it's time for you to collect it. And people say, well, there's just not going to be enough money for you to make it. And fear is often used to create unrest in kingdoms. But we don't serve as Americans because of the promise of how much money we get from the government. If there's anything to be said about our entitlement programs, is rather than inspire us, it seems to that it enslaves us. You look at all of the people who think, and rightfully, I'll tell you, the logic is sound. Why in the world would I want to go out? Why in the world would I want to go out and do something to better myself when people are just going to give me money for free? I had a young man tell me that once. Why in the world would I want to go out and work hard when people just give me money? That seems to be a better program. And I think, well, that person could be president one day. Because they see this, they see how much easier life is. If you're going to get paid for doing nothing, it's better to do nothing and get paid than doing something and get paid a whole lot less. No, I think the problem with entitlements is that sometimes it brings enslavement. Because instead of bringing people up out of the slums, it encourages them to stay down in the slums. When you think about how our political system works, and I'm not wanting to be political tonight, I'm not here up here to bash on anyone, I'm just pointing out the obvious, that oftentimes our politicians prey on our fears. They look at the job performance, and I think right now all eyes are upon our current administration about how well they handle any one of our crises, with the hopes that our government will fail. But you know what? If you are a loyal subject, you do not want your kingdom to fall. You don't want your king to fall. You want your king to survive, and you want your king to thrive, because the king should have your best interests at heart. And loyalty isn't something that's bought or manufactured. Loyalty, though, is based upon what I value the king offers me. I want you to tuck that one away for a little bit later in the hour, because we're going to pull that card back out. You've probably heard throughout history there was once a notion of this divine right of kings. It was actually, believe it or not, something that was at play when our King James Bible was translated, that there was an effort in order to stop the strives of the Reformation. Because there was much at stake. You know, the Reformation came down to, it was when Martin Luther looked at the teachings of the church at that day, the church that was very powerful. And the church had a whole lot of political influence, and the church could appoint kings. And you look at the conflicts that exist in this world today, and a lot of it isn't just political, it's religiously motivated. It's this religion against that religion. If you look at even just the structure of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Ireland, it's the division between the Catholics and the Protestants. You say, wait a minute, the church caused a whole lot of strife in that? And what do you mean, this divine right of kings? Well, the whole notion behind the divine right of kings was that kings were installed by God, and so kings could do whatever they wanted. They had divine right and divine privilege in making their judgments. They were above everyone else. And you say, well, how does that not match with what you told us this morning? How does that not connect? I'd like to take just a few moments and look at where we went. And I want to give you a principle tonight to help you in all of our doctrine. It's called not going too far. Because sometimes people do this with doctrine. People take something that the Bible says and they take it one step further in order to just take it, that logical conclusion out, and they speak where the Bible doesn't speak. And this divine right of kings is one such area. Sure, government is ordained by God out of his goodness. We saw this morning in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 2, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Sounds like there's the basis right there for the divine right of kings, that kings should be able to operate freely, that they're accountable to no one. That as subjects, because the king says it, it must be right and it must be true. But it's a big error to go against the king that God appoints. That doesn't make your case, Brandon, about this divine right of kings, because if it's an error to go against the king that God appoints, I'd like you to look at 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 15. The Lord, therefore, be judge, and judge between me and thee, and see and plead my cause, and deliver me out of thine hand. King's language here. We understand that kings are not, by divine right, above the rule and the reign and the access and the reproach of God. As a matter of fact, when we look at Israel's history, we find that each and every one of Israel's kings is subject to God, and they failed in a great way. Here's the problem with divine right of kings. God ordained rulers to restrain sin, but our rulers are human. In Romans chapter 13, verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must be needs subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And it was the God-ordained intention that our leaders, that the authority over us works to restrain sin and keep us safe through laws. And it's crazy that today law is thrown out. I had an email, craziest things. I had an email sent to me advertising a record that was being released, and it was just an advertisement, that junk mail that came into my inbox about this gospel record that was just being reduced and or introduced. And I, instead of deleting it, I clicked it, and it went through to the webpage to Walmart, wherever this record was being sold, and it said at the title that the title of this album of gospel hymns, and it had beside it a bracket that said explicit. The material was deemed objectionable and offensive. And I start looking at the song list, and it's the old rugged cross, the mercies of God, the sweet by and by, I'll fly away, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is what we label explicit, objectionable, and offensive today? Songs that we sing in church? Yeah. That's the state of the world that we live in, that's ruled and reigned by sin. And our kings, our leaders, are appointed by God. But it does not mean that, as once was thought in the world, that what accompanied that, that a king was above the law, could do whatever he wanted, that the king could operate because his subjects did not have any, there was no accountability to his subjects. I mean, here in America, we talked about it this morning, our leaders are subject to us. We vote them in, we vote them out. That's how we judge our leadership with the ballot box. That's why it's important for us as good citizens to be very actively involved in casting our ballots, because our ballots do matter and our voice does count. But our leaders are just like you and me, that have hearts that are prone to sin, and that the only way that you and I can make sound judgments and live a righteous life is to have God's righteousness in us through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So this notion of the divine right of kings, the error that hinges upon all of that, is the presupposition that the king is some sort of demigod, and he's not. He's a person just like us who will stand accountable to our God for his actions. And today it's no longer an issue. It's not even language that we use anymore, because it was something that died around the time of the Reformation. As individuals began to realize, you know what, I don't go into a booth and I don't ask forgiveness from a priest to absolve me of my sin. That's something that God alone can do. And I've got direct and personal access to God. And our kings are mortal men who, yes, are appointed by God over us, but we all will one day stand accountable, from the least in the kingdom to the greatest. We said all that to say this tonight, that a healthy kingdom requires a healthy relationship between the king and his subjects. I think this is interesting, that this finally at this moment that we introduce this concept of what a healthy kingdom looks like. It's when the king looks after his people, the people have that loyalty that's not manufactured through the promise of money or for fear or from the promise of titles. Though sometimes that's just the way that government works. But a healthy government, a healthy kingdom, has a healthy relationship between the king and his subjects. When it's out of balance, we call that a tyranny. Or we call it anarchy. But I'd like to take a few moments now to look at some lessons from Israel's kings. As we ask this question, do we have a healthy kingdom? And I'm going to go ahead and tell you the answer, no. But it doesn't take a scholar to be able to tell you that. As we look at three of Israel's first kings, I'd like to go back and just lay some groundwork for Israel and their kingdom. Before Saul came along, Israel was considered a theocracy ruled by God. You remember how the children of Israel left Egypt? You're sure Moses led them out as their deliverer, but it wasn't Moses that delivered them. It was God himself who led the children of Israel as a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. The tabernacle in the wilderness was a place of great worship for the Spirit of God. It was known among the children of Israel that the Spirit of God was there by the cloud and the fire that was manifest. There were procedures and precautions that the priest would take as they entered into the Holy of Holies, because if they did not enter properly, they would die in an instant because of the presence of our righteous and holy God. And the children of Israel, looking around, seeing the way that the inhabitants of the land, seeing the way the world worked, they longed for a king, and God gave them a king, King Saul. You know King Saul's story. He was so worried and consumed with the loyalty of his subjects, and rightfully so, because the king judges his success upon his loyalty. Remember King Saul's story? When I talk about King Saul, I wonder what's the story that comes to mind. Was it the David and Goliath event where we meet David, who's the small boy who comes and stands up against Goliath? They try to put the king's armor on him, but it's too big, so David just goes out to battle with just his slingshot and five smooth stones. Is that the one that came to mind? Or maybe when David played his harp because King Saul was in a fit, in a rage, and David coming in and singing with his harp would soothe and quiet King Saul. And then one day, while David was playing, King Saul pulls out his spear and tries to spear David. Do you remember the story? Or maybe you think about the story of King Saul, where he's so bent on trying to stop David, one of his most loyal subjects, who's gone out and fought not just for King Saul, but in the name of the one true God. And as he goes out and destroys the enemies of God, King Saul decides that David is an enemy to King Saul. And he sets out, and one night when the king comes and sleeps inside of a cave, remember, David slips out and cuts off a portion of the king's garment because he refuses to raise his hand against the king. All of this goes back to the bottom picture we have up here is a picture of King Saul talking to Samuel. And the problem that we see there in that moment is that King Saul had been told by God to utterly wipe out all of the Amalekites, that he was not to let any of them live, but he were to utterly conquer the Amalekites. And King Saul starts to look and thinks, well, wait a minute, there's a whole lot to be gathered here. Look at the great wealth, these beautiful animals, and you know what, we'll spare some of them. We can use them as servants. Surely this would make God happy if I was to be a good king and not let all this go to waste. And whatever his decision-making, whatever criteria he used, he made the wrong choice and did not follow God's commandment. And Samuel the prophet comes to him and says, your days are numbered, your kingdom will not stand. And from that moment on, King Saul's spirit was troubled. He began to look over his shoulder, began to wonder who it was that was going to take his kingdom from him. And that's why when a little shepherd boy steps up and does the work that a king should have done, and God works through the small little shepherd boy, and that shepherd boy that comes and plays upon his harp, and thank the Lord that we've got David's songs recorded in the book of Psalms to see his heart for God. I mean, Saul received the benefit of David's ministry to him, but in his jealous rage, he can't let go that urging, that worry, that fear that this young man might be the one to take my kingdom. That this young man who would go off to fight for Israel and come would one day be the one that the king goes after, and King Saul's end of his kingdom was spent chasing after his most loyal of subjects. It's interesting when you read 2 Samuel, the very first chapter, you find out a really interesting detail. It's the kind of details that gives you the chill bumps on the back of your neck. I encourage you to go back and read it tonight. For in this story, the word comes back that King Saul and Jonathan had gone out to battle, and that day the king had fallen. That a word had been sent to David by a messenger, that rather than fall at the hand of Israel's enemies, King Saul calls his armor bearer to hold his sword so that he can fall upon it. In a really interesting detail in 2 Samuel chapter 1, this armor bearer was an Amalekite whom God had told Israel to utterly destroy. And David in his wrath strikes down the armor bearer. King Saul's kingdom fell apart because he could not and he would not stop with his obsession about who was most loyal to him. But we look at David, and in David's kingdom, his story is equally tragic. Even though David's described as a man after God's own heart, David rules a broken kingdom. We know how David's story goes. David, the one who had slain 10,000s, mighty warrior, is sitting at home. In the time when kings normally go out to battle, he's at home and he's sitting on his roof one night and he spies Bathsheba. And he decides to take her as his wife. Or he decides to take her. Making her his wife would come later. And in order to deal with his conscience and with his sin, he decides to have Bathsheba's husband put to death. You know that story. In David's tragedy, the young son dies. But that wouldn't be the only tragedy that David knows. For as his son Absalom, who would be the king of Israel, if the succession was going to follow the kingly order, Absalom decides he can't wait and starts to work and to subdue his people, had become to the king to make their judgments or to ask the king for judgments. Absalom would pull them aside and reassure them. And he began to work to subvert the king, and he goes and declares himself as the leader. And a war breaks out between a father and a son. And David, the righteous, you know, the king who's in charge, the rightly appointed king, has war declared upon him by his son, fighting for a throne. And one day when Absalom's running, his hair gets caught in a branch. And when he's most vulnerable, he's slain. And news goes back to David, and his heart's broken. And all along David's journey, we find a man whose heart, yes, was after God's own heart, that God did much with him, but he would not ultimately be used by God to build the temple, the permanent temple. Because of David's failures and his inadequacies, but God would be honored, David and his descendants, and promised David that upon his bloodline, there would be a king that would come and sit and reign and rule with righteousness. And the third king of Israel, Solomon. And Solomon's kingdom was defined by great wisdom. You look at the book of Proverbs. You look at the book of Ecclesiastes. Song of Solomon's in there too. If you look at his wisdom books, incredible mind that he had. You remember Solomon's story, how God asks him, what could I give you? And Solomon didn't ask for great wealth, great power. He asks for great wisdom, and God gives Solomon wisdom and everything that comes along with that, a great kingdom. God would use Solomon to build the permanent temple, Solomon's temple. And it was one particular occasion that wisdom would come into play when Solomon would pass a judgment. Two women are arguing over whose child belonged to who. And as Solomon listens to both of the women, he orders one of his guards to cut the child in half. How many problems in life could not be settled that way, moms and dads, by cutting your children in half? No. Solomon knows that the real mother is going to be the one who loves the child enough to let the child live with someone who's not their mother, rather than see the child die, because the child doesn't survive being split in half. Every time I hear that tell of his judgment, I think to myself, I wouldn't even have thought of that one. How in the world? I mean, I would have waited around for DNA testing. Too bad they didn't have 23andMe back then or LabCorp to go get a blood test. In his wisdom, he makes sound judgments. And his legacy would be that he would leave us much wisdom, as his observations that we've been going through in Ecclesiastes are second to none. But you know Solomon's story. It wasn't going to end in victory. Because what comes along with the great power? All of those wives that he took, who brought in their gods into his household and turned his eyes away from Yahweh. And that it would be through his son, Rehoboam, that Israel's kingdoms would be divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and a great rift was coming among the people. And even though Solomon ruled with wisdom, his kingdom was inadequate. And if there's any lesson for us to learn tonight about our kings, is that we will not find the answer that we are looking for in our kings, even though they have been placed over us in this time. And thank the Lord that we do have someone over us tonight who is worrying about the big stuff that you and I never ever see day by day, moment by moment. But our hope and ultimate answer is not in that person or that party or that administration, because the day is coming when we will once and for all see the way a kingdom should be run. Tonight as we close, God ordained authority to protect us from our sin against one another. And that's what our laws do to govern us. That's why it's important this morning, we said, to pray for our leaders, to pray for our lawmakers, to pray for those in power over us, that they do get it right. And when they don't get it right, we pray that the Lord would turn their hearts. And if their hearts don't turn, that someone who does right will be in office to set it right. We have more than just a ballot box, church. We have our God on high that we go to in prayer and seek his counsel and to seek his direction and to seek his grace on the affairs of our lives day in and day out. We also see tonight that every kingdom is not ruled from righteousness, suffers the judgment of sin. We saw it in King Saul's kingdom. We saw it in David's kingdom, the heartache and the heartbreak that David knew. And we see it in King Solomon's kingdom. Even though he had a great legacy, look at what happened to Israel's kingdoms after him. Look how it all crumbles so quickly. And the point of all of this discussion about kings and kingdoms is this: Jesus is coming soon to show us how a healthy kingdom functions. And there's how we can pray. As our scriptures end, even so come, Lord Jesus. Let's all stand tonight as we're dismissed. Thank you so much for coming. Lord Jesus.